Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Birds of a feather have always flocked together. But now more than ever, says author Bill Bishop, Americans are retreating into increasingly insular communities of the like-minded. Red, blue, right, left, and so on. But safe within our homogeneous enclaves, are we shutting ourselves off from the everyday dialogue that makes democracy work? This hour, On Point, the clustering of America and its consequences. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is veteran journalist and author Bill Bishop. In the run-up to the 2004 presidential election, Bill's series of articles in the Austin American Statesman titled The Great Divide charted America's increasing political and cultural fragmentation. We talked with him then. Now, he argues, the country is more divided than ever. His new book is The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
It's great to have you back. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom, and welcome back, Bill.
Bill Bishop, I maybe I'm all wet, but I thought the notion was out there that we were getting over this, that this was so 2000, so 2004, that people were kind of tired of polarization and maybe headed in another direction. What have you found?
Well, we found more of the same. I think people are tired of polarization, and they wish the other side would give up and agree with them. That's kind of the conclusion that the Pew Research Center came to last year in a poll when they asked that question exactly. And people are, I think that's why during every presidential race, or the last several anyway, we have the man from hope and the uniter, not the divider, and a new man from hope and the maverick from Arizona. Americans have the sense that the process of politics doesn't work, but they don't extend from that a belief that that they need to change.
So there's the dream of unity, but you say the reality really isn't there. The big sort goes on and on. What is it? People have been moving into or lived in enclaves for a long time. What's the twist? What's the matter of degree that you're outlining here?
Well, that's what surprised us. The most human thing in the world is to find safety among others like yourself. But what we found was that from the mid-1970s to 2004, communities became increasingly either Republican or Democratic. And I think that's kind of the tail of the dog, because as we got into the what happened over the last 30 years more and more, what we could see is that in every aspect of society and how markets work, how churches work, how clubs are being formed and how neighborhoods are being formed, those areas of life are increasingly insular and like-minded. And so the political aspect of this is really the end of the road. But you're right. We can see the same sorting within the Democratic primary in 2008 in exactly the same way as in the general election in 2004.
Bill, walk us through some of the big pieces of evidence that you cite of the big sort you say is underway. What are some of the numbers, some of the dynamics, some of the evidence that illustrate that?
Well, the easiest way to see the political end is to we counted the number of people who lived in landslide counties in close elections, and those are people that live in counties where the election was decided by 20 percentage points or more.
And so counties that went very heavily one way or another in the outcome, anything but neck and neck. Okay,
right. And so you had 1976, very close election. About a quarter of the people lived in a landslide community. And as the elections continued on through the 1990s and 2000s, which they were all very close, it increased almost in a stair-step fashion, so that by 2004 you had about half the people living in a landslide county.
That means that county is very, very heavily weighted toward one party or the other, Republicans or Democrats.
One party. At the same time, having a national election that's 50-50, so you have this kind of mass case of national cognitive dissonance, right, where you look around yourself and you see agreement, and then you look at an election that was closely contested. The interesting thing is when we started counting in 2008, the division between Hillary Clinton supporters and Barack Obama supporters, we found that, again, about half the people lived in a landslide county in a race that is virtually tied. And the divisions were largely the same. If you look at a map of Missouri from 2004 in Missouri in 2008, it's hard to tell the difference. The geographic pattern of how people voted is almost the same. Clinton picks up the Republican counties. Obama picks up the strongly Democratic counties.
And people, as you say, have trouble figuring out. There was that wonderful quote from playwright Arthur Miller back in 2004. He said, "How can the polls be neck and neck? I don't know one Bush supporter." Well, right, because they don't live where he lives, I guess.
Well, the social psychology of all this is really interesting, because if you get a group of people, classic experiment was in France. You have French students who didn't like the United States, and you get them together and you have them talk about the United States for 2 hours. By the end of the 2 hours, they'll dislike the United States even more. And so the process that takes place in like-minded communities is that the majority grows stronger in their beliefs, and the minority withdraws from participation. They vote less. We talk to people who say they would not speak up at book clubs. In one little town, Democrats, this was in a 75% Republican county in Texas, Democrats built a float for the July 4th parade, but when it came time to ride the float down the middle of Main Street, no Democrat would get on the float because they didn't want to be identified. And so it's this process of reinforcing the majority feeling and diminishing the participation of minorities.
We'll talk about that, but what's driving this, Bill? I mean, presumably people don't go, when they're moving, they're looking for a new house, they don't go online and say, "I want to live in a Republican district or a Democrat district." Maybe they do, but I wouldn't think so.
No, but I mean, we all know. I mean, I've devised several games now to figure out what sort of neighborhood you live in, and one is the bowling ball art game, which we played when we moved to our 90% Democratic neighborhood here in Austin. We liked our neighborhood not because we checked out voting records, but we had a neighbor who had bowling ball art in his front yard, or the dog poll. We went up to. In 2006, we went to vote, and we were patting a dog in the line to vote at the Congress Avenue Baptist Church. And I asked the owner the dog's name, and the owner said the dog's name was Che.
And as in Che Guevara.
Anytime you could take a random dog and it's named after a South American revolutionary, you know, your odds are you're. And we were, oddly enough, at that time sitting 5 blocks from where liberal columnist Jim Hightower lived and from where Molly Ivins lived.
So for someone who might be looking for a conservative neighborhood, whether overtly or you know, passively, what signifiers would they be looking for?
Well, when I talked to Republicans in Scott County, Minnesota, which is outside of Minneapolis, and Minneapolis has a lot of those hip neighborhoods like I was talking about, and these people wanted none of it. And Randy Penrod, who was the head of the Republican Party there in Scott, which is about 65% Republican, said, I have a theory. The more space between people, the more Republican the neighborhood. And essentially that was right. When you look at the geographic distribution, the density of population by county, the denser the population, the more Democratic the vote was in 2004. Or you can check the cohabitation rates of the state.
big yards, big GOP turnout. Jack Beatty, what do you make of this? Are we all moving into echo chambers where every neighbor thinks just like us, whether it's Republican or Democrat, and the old American conversation is over?
Well, I don't think it's over, but first, Bill, I had a Bill Bishop moment in San Francisco a couple of years ago. I thought about you. I was sitting in a bar talking to a fellow, and he said loudly, "Do you realize I am one of two Republicans in San Francisco?" And at the other end of the bar, a guy said, "Yeah, and I'm the other one." And you know, that's not far from the truth. You know, what you describe here, Bill, really strikes me as quite a paradoxical picture, starting about 1965, I mean, it can almost be limited to the year, as you show, the main integrative institutions in American life, the parties, the churches, the bowling leagues, all started to fall apart, partly because we had this new ethic of self-expression. People were choosing their own communities. They wanted to make statements about their own values. And this falling apart of community was made for a huge social crisis. And as you tell the story, that crisis has been healed partly by people moving near and being with people who believe things, who believe what they believe, and that this has, in effect, helped to deal with, if not ameliorated, this crisis in community, a good thing for society. But on the other side, it's made for political polarization. So what was good for American society and good for people in terms of their, you know, their capacity to have happiness has been bad for the American polity. It produced in the year 2005 the most polarized Congress in 120 years.
We'll look at what's happened there. But all in all, Bill Bishop, you're pretty unhappy about the effects of Americans living among such like-minded people and having kind of the narrow conversations that would logically ensue there.
I'm more interested in it than unhappy. And I think Jack has pinpointed a really important point, which is that we've substituted our sense of local community for our sense of a nation. And in a way, that has been really good because we've been able to have this experiment in how to live that varies from place to place, which is exciting.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about like-minded Americans not just voting together, but living together, moving into like-minded communities like never before, and the consequences of that. My guest is Bill Bishop. He joins us from Austin, Texas, longtime journalist with the Austin American Statesman, now author of The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's hear from right around the country. Let's go to Salt Lake City. And Sean, hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Great. What do you see there, Sean?
Hey, you know what? I believe that humans feel the environment they live in and the view, the point of view around them, and so they tend to adapt to that. Instead of maybe as a conservative moving into Utah, you move into Utah, sense the environment around you,
yep,
and adapt to those views.
Bill Bishop, what do you say to Sean? He says you may not go there on purpose, but you move in and you naturally just absorb the politics around you. What do you say, Bill?
Well, you know, there is some evidence that political scientists have come up with that people will change their beliefs in order to be with their tribe. And that may be why we have see such alignment in beliefs. I had a county commissioner in Oregon say that anti-abortion people in his area no longer ask him about abortion. They ask him about property rights because they know that his answer on property rights will reflect what he believes about abortion. And so I think Sean is somewhat right, but I think basically people stay away from places where they won't get along. But there is that process that he's talking about that certainly is the case.
Are we somehow prisoners of trends that pull us into like-minded communities, whether we're planning to do that or not? You write about college graduates and graduates of graduate school and how they tend to cluster and its implications. What are those?
Well, we looked at that when we found this process by looking at how economies were working. And what we found was during this, the Big Sort is big because it covers everything. And beginning in the 1970s, at the same time we saw this political polarization, people with BA degrees began to cluster in particular places. And so Austin slurped up people with BA degrees, and Cleveland didn't collect as many. And that had all these regional economic consequences. And so the sorting that we see with politics is really just a reflection of this larger thing that Jack was talking about. The markets have segmented and churches have become, you know, you can tell your church whether it has a little rainbow flag on the front, what kind of church it is. And churches are no longer national in scope. They're very particular and aimed at exclusive communities and neighborhoods. It's really a reflection of how we live, not a reflection of policy or politics.
Mega churches, you write, becoming kind of magnets for entire orbits of socialization and community get-together.
Well, and this was my favorite story, is that the mega churches were formed based on a technique devised by a missionary in India who said that in order to get the castes and the villages to come into the church and become Christians, you had to think of them as a homogenous unit. And he devised the Donald McGavern devised the homogenous unit principle of church growth, which was adopted by the young preachers like Rick Warren in Orange County, who created the megachurch. And except their castes and their villages weren't in a third world, they were in the suburbs of America. And they looked at this particular type of person moving to the suburbs as a caste, and they designed churches to reinforce that person's belief and comfort.
Let's go from Salt Lake City to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi. I grew up in a rural area, but moved to the city about 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and I've noticed that though the cities are associated with diversity, because I couldn't choose my friends in the countryside, there was actually less homogeneity in a rural setting. Mm-hmm. What does the guest have to say about this trend in rural versus urban settings?
You're saying when you were still in the countryside, you kind of took who you got for neighbors and learned to live with them.
Exactly. And my family was full of all different sorts of political views. My friends were conservative, liberal, very diverse.
Bill Bishop, Rebecca came looking for diversity and is not sure she found it in the city.
You know, my wife and I used to own a weekly newspaper in rural Texas, and I couldn't agree with Rebecca more. I mean, when we lived there, we went to the Rebecca's Club for dinner, and we knew the bum on the street and the bank president and in a way, yes, life in a small town where you are thrust into associations with a lot of people you wouldn't see in the city, and our life in a town of 3,500 in rural Texas was in many ways a lot richer than my life in hip, swaggering 1.6 million Austin.
Jack Beattie, what's your sense? I mean, was it ever thus? Bill's, quite ready to say we've always had enclaves of a kind. At the same time, people feel how conversations have gotten flattened and polarized. I mean, one of our kind of motivating principles with this show is to try and make a big tent where everybody can come in and talk from all kinds of angles on the cultural and ideological compass. But is that really so rare today, so much rarer than it ever was?
Well, in the past, there have been periods like this. I think after the Civil War, you had a period somewhat like this. It was a period of what one scholar calls men in motion. People were moving all the time. And just to look at the churn through the city of Boston, for example, is amazing. Over 1 million people in a few years just in and out of the city. And with all this churning and moving, people needed community. They needed a tribal base. They needed some kind of solidarity. And they found it in party. That was the era of maximum partisanship because the political party had become a kind of, as one person said, political church. And people joined the party as much to feel part of something, because they were moving all the time, as any other reason. And I think today, Bill, that there's something like that going on. Maybe there isn't quite so much mobility as in the 19th century, but there's a lot of it. And I really think there's an element here of identity. People need to feel something stable, and that the parties now bear a kind of valence, a kind of charge, a kind of community investment, an investment in identity that they didn't have, say, in a more stable America where there, say, the post-war America, where there was a kind of, a middle ground in politics.
When you had the bowling alley and the Elks Club and Rotary and all that. Bill Bishop, how about it? Parties coming back and stepping into that role of some kind of cohesive social touchstone for people?
Well, I think parties are aligning with those communities that are forming based on other things, mainly lifestyle and ways of life. I mean, we talk during this election about all these demographic categories of white working class. That is, I think, exactly the wrong way to think about how we're living, and certainly not the way people think about how they're living. I had a woman from San Diego describe herself as an ocean-oriented person. And that's the marketing people. Jack is really good at this because he sees this change. Around the time Jack was talking about, there was mass movement and the markets were mass. And the idea was having mass advertising. Well, but since that time, markets have shrunk. And now advertising and markets are targeted to particular lifestyle groups. So power bars are marketed to first marathon runners and then tennis players and then kayakers. And that's what's happening in politics, too, is that political parties are aligning with those lifestyle choices that, just as Jack said, give us that sense of self-expression and self-fulfillment.
Well, really, you two are headed in opposite directions, Jack. Bill's suggesting it's the other way around, but you're suggesting people are looking for what? A kind of a cultural comfort zone, an ideological comfort zone in their community, not just being exploited or tapped because they've got a big yard.
I think so, but who knows in which way the causality runs. You know, Bill, I mean, there's another view, of course, and Bill knows this and he talks about it, but just to have you respond to it, Bill, you know, you the work of Morris Fiorina, Alan Wolf, others, they say, look it. There's much less polarization in America than people think. These studies of polarization are about extreme partisans, and they're about elites. That if you look at the basic group of Americans, there's a rough kind of consensus, basically for some kind of abortion rights, basically for some kind of minimal government presence in the economy. Or look at today, the consensus, Bush is a failed president, 7 out of 10 Americans. The consensus that Social Security privatization was a bad idea, 7 out of 10 thought so. That the Iraq War we shouldn't have done it, 6 out of 10. That we should get out of there, 6 out of 10. So there's a lot of consensus even right now. What do you say to people who say, looking, you know, with Wolf and others, and say, look at the big picture, there's a lot more consensus, this is just elites, and then in the narrow frame, look at all the consensus we have today about these issues.
Bill?
Well, there's a big political science debate over that, and there's a lot of evidence that, I mean, here's an example. People find agreement in abortion rights because they say, well, most people aren't for total bans or total allowance of abortions. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's kind of a weird way to define the middle. That would mean a person who is in favor of abortion in cases of rape, but against it in cases of incest. would be considered in the middle on the abortion issue. And in that way, maybe the middle is big. But what we don't see, what I don't see, I don't see my neighbors moving to Lubbock, and I don't see I defy anybody to go to Amarillo and then come to downtown Austin or Cambridge, Massachusetts or San Francisco and say, yeah, these are the same places, because they just aren't. And it goes beyond policy. Mm. It goes into what people want out of life. I think really Jack and I are saying the same thing, that people are looking for self-fulfillment in places other than the country. And they're finding it in their community. They're not finding it in their jobs, but they're finding it in their communities and in the way they live. And what political parties are doing are finding ways to align themselves with those feelings. So Bush in 2004 devises the Applebee's campaign. It wasn't a campaign based on issues. It was a campaign that tried to recreate the sense of community within Bush voters. So people were voting not for a candidate with whom they often had disagreements over policy, but a candidate that was seen to reflect their way of life and their community.
So look up and see yourself there, feel your community endorsed, however you may define it. Let's get a call from Paul in Panama City, Florida. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just curious. I'm just wondering why it really matters. I live in a wonderful community. I teach here. And the reason I moved here was because of family, because of a good job. The beach is close. And on my little block, it's a very diverse little block. But that wasn't why I moved here. You know, immigrants came to this country. My you know, forefathers came to this country. And where did they live? They lived in insular little communities within large cities. And then they spread out.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering, you know, why does it matter? Within my own home, I can think how I choose and, you know, choose whoever I want to, you know, converse with. And it just seems like the, you know, why so much time would be spent on worrying about, you know, why people are becoming insular.
Paul, let us pick it up. We've just got a couple minutes before the break here, but Bill, expand on that. Paul's challenging here and says, well, what about it? Why does it matter? Speak to the, elaborate on the consequences that you describe.
Well, the country had a choice at the beginning, and because it was created of essentially island communities, is the way Robert Wiebe described it. And the decision
your
was
little
that,
Italy, your little this, your little that,
and country, you know, and out in the countryside, mm-hmm. places that where there wasn't much contact, and the feeling among some was that there was no way to bind this kind of nation together, that they didn't have enough in common, and the decision was no, we'll do better if we find a way to bring all those different ideas and different kinds of people together in a place. We'll come up with better solutions to our national problems, and. In a way, the caller is right. It doesn't matter, except on a national basis, we're unable to come to any kind of conclusion about just about anything. Today, there is no Democrat who is more conservative than the most liberal Republican in Congress, both the House and the Senate. There's simply no overlap in the parties. There's no discussion. The discussion between parties has disappeared. And so the big issues of the day are left to kind of flop around out there in Congress. And so we don't have a decision on health care and immigration. And so national policy is being made up locally by towns such as Austin to having a environmental global warming policy. And so we have great experimentation locally, but nationally this lack of consensus is taking away what really made America was America's promise to begin with.
And you're suggesting that if people lived in less like-minded communities, if they ran into each other at the cafe or the bar or the bowling alley and talked things out locally, it would end up creating an environment that supported consensus in a way that this one doesn't?
Well, the problem is that our enemies are always our enemies and our friends are always our friends. And this is a dangerous a state for a democracy or for any society. There need to be a lot of cross-cutting issues so that you're not always on the opposite side. And the situation we have today is that the parties on the – or people in both parties are on opposite sides on every issue. And it's the rare time when you see members from different parties crossing over to come to some kind of solution about anything. But that is really an extension of how we live. I mean, our representatives really are representing us, because they represent communities that are increasingly one side or the other. And so it's making national policy really hard to figure out.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about like-minded Americans, not just voting together, but living together, moving into like-minded communities like never before. My guest is Bill Bishop. His new book is The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's go to Portsmouth, Virginia, and Sherry. Hi, Sherry. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was explaining that I live in the house that my grandmother lived in for 50 years, and I moved away, came back with a family, and now this neighborhood that was segregated back when I was a child, there were some railroad tracks that separated the blacks from the whites
right.
parts of the neighborhood. It is now completely integrated, but its segregation is now based on income. So what used to be the white neighborhood is now integrated racially, but everybody there has to have, you know, money. And on the other side, in the house where my grandmother lived, which was a black community,
yeah.
It is also integrated, but again, along the lines of, you know, income as opposed to anything else.
That's a great point of reference, a house where your grandmother lived for 50 years, and it sounds like you spent some of your childhood. Do you have a sense, Sherry, of the you've got the income stratifications figured out, but what about the politics? Is there this kind of lockstep like-mindedness in these communities that Bill's describing?
Again, along the lines of income, and so it's a small city, a little bit under 100,000, but in a rural area, in very many ways. And so it is, again, along the lines of, we just, in fact, had an election on May 6th where I was a school board member who got kicked out of office.
Ow.
Because the division is now among those who believe in a more progressive future as opposed to those who want to maintain the things the way that they have always been in the past.
But which way is money voting and which way is poverty voting here?
Poverty doesn't vote. We had less than 10% of the registered voters who came out for this election. So essentially, I lost the election by about 100 votes, literally. And that's because we had no one who came out. No one thought that an incumbent, you know, with 98% chance of being reelected would have to have people come out and vote. But that's what happened because the local newspaper came out against me. And that's the thing also is that all of our media is controlled by one or two corporations. And so there's no opportunity for any kind of different voice, alternative voice to have a say-so. We have Landmark Communications in our market here that owns our major dailies, newspaper, as well as any alternative weeklies. And so there's no opportunity to fight back from any segment of the community, even the ones who know what they want to say.
Sherry, stick with us. It sounds like you're very active in your community. Bill, what do you say? Here's an example, I mean, of a kind of clustering that Americans knew extremely well not so many decades ago, and again lately, and sometimes in different ways, racial clustering on opposite sides of the tracks there. And Sherry says in her town that's been replaced with income clustering with the consequences you hear her describe. Bill, what do you say?
Well, racial segregation so far outweighs political segregation. You know, I don't want to hardly compare them. But what I heard, the interesting description Sherry gave of her school board race was that it was between people who wanted progress and people who wanted the old ways. And to me, that doesn't talk about income. That talks about visions of what life ought to be. And in fact, we get into the book into a school fight in West Virginia in 1974, where those were exactly the lines of division. And it really was about how people viewed life, and it extended to the church, and it extended to rural versus urban, and educated versus uneducated, and so. But I think Sherry has it right that it's more a vision of how life ought to be in schools or elsewhere, rather than income or these other things that we normally count with politics.
Sherry, give us your report within your small city of 100,000, relatively small, not tiny by any means, but do you see communities segregating by perspective on the world there, or do people still talk with each other at the bar, at the bowling alley, at the town park?
Tom, can I say one last thing in
yeah.
terms of our history?
Mm-hmm.
We are one of the oldest cities in the country, and we have interracial youth gangs here in the Hampton Roads. But this is also where we had the first interracial community in the Great Dismal Swamp, which is an underground railroad stop where you had your Native Americans, Africans, and Europeans who wanted to escape from the larger community. They came together in terms of an interracial community, and that was here. And so we have a history to speak to something totally different from what the perception is in terms of how history repeats itself. And we're repeating history, and yet people don't seem to understand that because everything is still cast in terms of race as opposed to economics, which is a far more unifying issue than race can ever be.
Sounds like you're ready to move on, but it's not that simple. Thanks very much for that. Let's get a call from Boston. And Chris, hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I think the problem, I have a slightly different take on this. I think the problem is we have a $3 trillion budget, and that's a lot. That buys a lot of power. And I think the prize there in gaining control of that for Republicans and Democrats is so great that bipartisanship just goes out the window. And I think that if there was about half of that, I think, and if there was just less nervousness about the other side getting control, I think there'd be much less of this type of partisanship and mean-spiritedness.
So, Chris, you see it as a top-down battle for power and resources rather than a community-up kind of polarization or balkanization in the country?
I see the balkanization as resulting as just a psychological response to how big and powerful Washington, and I'm not trying to sell you a line of libertarian sort of goods here. I think that the stakes are so high, and
we got it. Do you live in a block full of libertarians then, Chris, or no?
No, I wish there was such a thing. I would go there.
Bill, what do you say to Chris?
Well, there is a group trying to create Ron Paulville in West Texas, so maybe that's the... You know, what interests me is that we've taken a kind of consumer attitude towards democracy, and we expect things to, you know, we get our cars exactly the way we want them, and we get our hamburgers the way we want them, and everything is manufactured down to the micro level so that you can get exactly what you want, and we apply that same attitude towards democratic life, and I think that's where we break down. We don't have a way. We don't have a way to shift out of our consumer attitude about things to a democratic attitude about how the country can work.
But don't Americans still, at some level, thrill to the idea of pulling together? People love to talk about unity and consensus, as you say. Isn't, no matter how we may have sorted ourselves out geographically, isn't there still an ideal here that people find attractive? I mean, it's part of what gets me up every day, you know, and coming to work, the possibility via the radio to make that happen. Don't people feel it in their personal lives, their political lives? You don't just want to sit down with folks who think exactly the same way you do. Isn't that part of the appeal of being in this country?
It's one of the appeals, and that's why a political scientist in Nebraska sat down with people in Nebraska, and they said the same thing. And they said that we can't understand why those people in California are screwing things up. And so it's tough. I mean, we say we want stuff, and we see that a lot in the 2008 campaign. But do we really want it? And, you know, it's not working class people that are those who are at fault here. Diana Mutz has a fantastic book, Hearing the Other Side, where she talks about studies of cross-cutting political discourse. And the people who are least likely to have discussion with someone who disagrees with them are Americans who have been to graduate school.
who are supposed to be the real fancy degrees, and they don't want to listen.
Oh, yeah.
Jack, what about it? I mean, I have to, for me personally, those cross-cutting conversations are very exciting. When I'm in the middle of one, I know that I'm getting closer to, you know, grappling with the real diversity of perspectives in this country. I like that. Isn't that broadly appealing to people?
You would think so, and it certainly keeps you awake. John Stuart Mill warns about the deep slumber of dogmatic opinion, but the fact is, people put comfort ahead, I think, of that kind of spark and debate. You know, in a country with so much diversity, with so much clangor in the air of opinion, people seem to want a comfort. And politics, I think, is acting more and more like that. The reference group, well, so that very finding that people with graduate degrees are those least likely to have cross-cutting conversations, that's quite extraordinary. But, you know, there was a period like this in American politics, the 1920s, when there was the same split, rural, urban. One book about the period spoke of the politics of provincialism, that there were these provinces that didn't talk. And it looked like the country was coming apart. And it was also an era of great inequality. We're right back pretty much to that kind of inequality today. And the two things were related, the polarization and the inequality. But then there was an amalgamating event that brought Americans together, that cut across all these provincialisms, and it was, unfortunately, an economic catastrophe, the Great Depression. And there are some political scientists, Keith Poole, you quote his work, Bill, and others, who think, look, before we get some consensus on moving ahead with a lot of issues, we're going to need some kind of big national crisis to cut through these provincialisms that are keeping us apart.
But what a price to pay.
Yeah, what a price to
pay. Something nobody would want to hope for. Let's go to Lena in Little River, South Carolina. Hi, Lena. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you.
I wanted to question the fact that no one has mentioned what happened during the Second World War when the whole country pulled together to win the war, and we sent in collected our fat cans, and we planted victory gardens.
Yep.
And we elected Roosevelt for a third term unprecedentedly, and I think that's amazing polarization.
Amazing unity in a way, but did it take the Great Depression to create that? Do you get Americans pulling together and talking across boundaries without some calamity like that in war, Lena?
Oh, I thought it was the war which caused it.
Well, maybe one after another there, but does it take something of that scale to make it happen?
Mm-hmm. Probably. But we became a world power over the period of the decades of our country, and we're still considered a world power or the world power. So something good is happening with the ups and downs.
Yeah. We hear it, Lena, and we thank you for your call. Let's get one from Kathy in Lansing, Michigan. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I find this a very interesting conversation because I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is where University of Michigan is, and it's a fairly, I grew up in a fairly nice neighborhood and everything, and I moved to Lansing to teach. This is an inner city school district. The schools that I teach in, maybe 68% get free and reduced lunch.
Okay.
And so I did not move toward my comfort level. I moved away from my comfort level because my top priority was to do something that would benefit the world. And I wonder if there are other people doing that and what your guest has to say about that.
Well, since you're going against what Bill describes as a national trend, how's it worked out for you? You moved out of your comfort zone. Has it felt fulfilling? Good? Are you glad you've done it?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, the students that I teach really need me, and I'm there for them, and not just as a teacher, but, you know, they come and talk to me after school about things, and yeah, I feel like I'm doing something positive for the world, and I'm very happy about that.
So you've moved into a different economic zone, but do they challenge you in terms of their perspective on the world? Do they challenge you politically, Kathy?
Oh, absolutely, because their perspective is so different from what I grew up with. You know, I grew up basically in a Democratic household, and, you know, I look at the people around me, and, you know, I'm sure you know that Michigan is suffering terrible, terrible economic times.
Yeah.
And the people around me, you know, families are homeless. And I talk to people and I listen to what they have to say. And I could never understand from a personal point of view where they are. But if I can talk to them and listen to them, I learn so much more about the values that people have and why they have them. And, yeah, it's very interesting.
Kathy, thanks so much for your call from Lansing. Bill Bishop, what about consequences here? If the country continues on the path that you've described here, clustering into communities of like-minded people, where do you see that taking the American democracy, the American experiment?
Well, it's stymied nationally. Locally, it becomes more vibrant. And so we have a country that is becoming increasingly diverse internally, but sort of dead democratically nationally, and so that sort of trend continues. Kathy's remark brought to mind a story I heard of a gay couple that moved to a small town in South Carolina for exactly the reason that she described. They wanted to show that a gay couple could live in a small town, and that they it was sort of a freedom rider exercise of sexually, and so I think people are making those kinds of decisions, but they're making those decisions because they see the country as it is.
Barack Obama has presented himself as an agent of change, maybe as the personification of breaking across lines, out of comfort zones. Do you see the next president making a big difference in this trend one way or another, whoever it may be?
Well, that's why it's so interesting to see the pattern of his vote, which is overwhelmingly urban and overwhelmingly and from Democratic counties. I mean, recreated within the Democratic primary is exactly the political and cultural split that we see between Kerry and Bush from 2004.
More diversity on the Hillary Clinton side of the ledger?
Well, no. In a way, it's they've split the country in the same way. I mean, you have half the people living in counties in the Democratic primary where the an exactly even election wasn't even at all. And I mean, when you break down the numbers, Obama's strength was in the rural. I mean, it was in the urban South. And that's where he built up a 1.4 million vote lead over Clinton. And it's really as isolated as every other election we've had since the early 90s.
What a picture. Bill Bishop's new book is The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. Wow. Jack Beatty, what about it? You ready to go have a beer with Rush Limbaugh? Mix it up?
It'll have to
Can
be
I
a
want to be there?
Make it three. Make it four. Make it a cup of tea.
I'll be there.
We'll be dry. All right. Bill, in Austin, Texas, Bill Bishop, thank you so much for the new book. Come back when you do some more reporting, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, guys.
And Jack, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.